This is Culturetopia, your Gracie-winning weekly roundup of the best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Sonari Quentin, producer for All Things Considered.
You can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
a new book looks at the girl who may have inspired Lewis Carroll's classic Alice in Wonderland.
And Ozzy Osbourne, another English person, has committed his life to autobiography.
And we commemorate the 200th birthday of Chopin. But first,
Oscars, 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 Oscars. This is the last week we're going to be talking about the Oscars for a while. You've probably heard of four of this year's five Oscar contenders for Best Animated Feature: Coraline, Up, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and The Princess and the Frog. But the fifth film is largely unknown to American audiences. That's because The Secret of Kells is Irish and it hasn't yet opened here. Luckily, NPR film critic Bob Mondello was able to catch a sneak peek. He has this review.
When I say The Secret of Kells harks back to an earlier style of drawing, I don't just mean pre-digital animation. I mean the kind of drawing that monks did in the Middle Ages, those curlicued borders and ornate letters they hand-painted in holy books. Ireland's Book of Kells, for instance, a 9th-century volume that took many monks, many years to illuminate, apparently with an excited 10-year-old apprentice named Brendan looking on.
Tell me, Brendan, would you like to help me?
Oh, yes, please. I help the brothers find quills all the time.
Calm down, little brother. The book is a beacon in these dark days of the Northmen. Do you want to see the most beautiful page? The one that will turn darkness into light?
The old monk opens the volume and flips through it to a blank page.
It is to be the key row page.
Is to be, if they can complete it before the abbey is overrun by Viking barbarians, those Northmen he mentioned. The abbot, who happens to be Brendan's uncle, wants his monks to stop their illustrating and start building protective battlements, an idea that's not popular with the artists.
Uncle just wants to protect us from the outside. When the Northmen come to Kells,
prepare or meet your doom.
It is not funny.
The abbot sees us. He is not happy because we are not working on the wall.
There were enough of that. What about the books? Does he not value them?
If there were no books, all knowledge would be lost for eternity.
This qualifies as a pretty heady idea in a kid flick world that mostly deals with talking frogs, singing chipmunks, and balloon trips. That medieval monks protected knowledge is historical, of course, helped Europe rebuild after the Dark Ages. But you wouldn't want the film to spend all its time on that. So Brendan slips out into the woods, where he meets a helpful sprite and a nasty monster, giving the animators a chance to play with form and format until the Vikings attack. The visual style the filmmakers have chosen is striking and quite beautiful at times, but deliberately flat, like pictures in a medieval manuscript. No 3D trickery, no moving backgrounds. Trees are stylized, people geometric. One monk's essentially a curve with a bald patch. And movement is as primitive as in Saturday morning cartoons. When you think that at the Oscars, The Secret of Kells is going up against Up, its chances seem hopeless, and probably are. But you know, there's something kind of captivating about a film that's been painstakingly drawn to glorify the craft of illustration, that's not all jokes and slapstick, and that's comfortable using retro techniques because what else makes sense for bringing to life the gold and scarlet ornamentation in ancient manuscripts? I confess I actually choked up when that ornamentation came briefly to life in the film's final moments. Low tech, but high art. The secret to The Secret of Kells. I'm Bob Mondello.
Netta, I have a secret. I've lived almost 40 years on this earth, and I have never seen nor read anything related to Alice in Wonderland.
Well, it's now a chance for you to catch up by seeing a new movie done by none other than Tim Burton.
Exactly. Alice in Wonderland will be returning to the big screen, this time directed by Tim Burton. There's also a new historical novel that tells the story of the young girl, Alice Little, who inspired Carroll. Lewis Carroll was the pen name for the Reverend Charles Dodgson. In the late 1860s, Dodgson was a budding photographer and a professor at Oxford University, where Little's father was dean. When Alice was 7, Dodgson took her photo, and that photo was the inspiration for Alice, I Have Been, the new book by Melanie Benjamin. NPR's Leanne Hansen spoke to Benjamin about the book and that photograph.
It is of a very young girl, like many of Carol's or Dodgson's photographs were. She's wearing rags, but they are very artfully arranged so that bits of skin are showing. What fascinated me the most is the expression in this very little girl's face. The expression was so, I thought, worldly and frank and adult and, dare I say, womanly.
Sultry would be a way to describe it, even though she's 7 years old.
That's the thing. It's a startling picture.
Right. In the novel, I mean, you have members of her family sort of warning her, or they just don't trust Charles Dodgson very much. But Alice Little loves him. You know, she seems to be way beyond her years in the way that she feels for him. What happened that ended their relationship?
We don't know, and that was one of my greatest gifts as a novelist. When I depict Alice having this crush on him, these feelings for him, she's 11 in the book, and I don't think that that is as unusual a thing as we might think. I can remember when I was 11 and I had quite a crush on my fifth grade teacher who, you know, I think we have feelings, and particularly in the Victorian times, a girl could be married legally at the age of 12. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's that unusual that she had these feelings for this man who seemed to pick her out of her family and hold her as something special in her life. And then as far as what ended the relationship, when he was 31 and she was 11, there is this abrupt break in the relations. It resulted in her mother burning all the correspondence between the two of them, and in his relations later on deleted the portions of his diary that dealt with this time. For 150 years, historians have been trying to figure out what happened. Every few years, someone else comes up with a new concept or a new theory or a new idea. Alice and her family never, ever spoke of this. There were rumors. There were rumors around Oxford. But what I take away from this is that 150 years later, we still so very much want to know what happened.
Well, now that makes me want to pick up the book. I want to know what happened. You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Next, an interview with another noted author. Ozzy Osbourne has written, well, co-written his autobiography. It's called I Am Ozzy, and it begins with quite the disclaimer. You ready for this?
Other people's memories of the stuff in this book might not be the same as mine. I ain't going to argue with them. Over the past 40 years, I've been loaded on booze, coke, acid. When you read the heroes, what's dribbled out of the jelly I call my brain when I asked it for my life story.
That's only one of my Ozzy Osbourne impersonations. Osbourne is an original member of Black Sabbath. He staged a successful solo career and starred in The Osbournes, a reality show with his wife Sharon and two children. Scott Simon recently spoke to the man known as the Prince of Darkness and naturally asked him about two of his most infamous moments involving little helpless flying animals.
I'm so over the dove, the bat, you know, it's everybody knows what the answer is. It's just one of them things, unfortunately, that people will remember me by when I pass on, I suppose. But, you know, the answer is, yes, I did buy the head of a dove. Yes, I did buy the head of a bat. It's a stupid thing to do, but I did eat, you know.
You're among, I gather, millions of people on this planet who can say that the Beatles changed their life.
Absolutely.
So what happened? Recapture that for us.
Well, I didn't want to live in that environment for the rest of my life, and in the working class environment. I was suffering from, I still do, from dyslexia and attention deficit disorder. When you're in a class of 40 kids and the teacher's talking to you about writing stuff on the blackboard and you honestly haven't got a clue what he's talking about, it's very difficult. So when I heard the Beatles, I thought, that's it. That's what I want to be. I want to be a Beatle, you know. And I bought the Beatle suit, the Beatle wigs, the Beatle photographs, anything with the Beatles on. And I still get a lot of pleasure out of it. And I still listen to McCartney and Lennon and Harrison and Ringo Starr. It was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life to meet Paul McCartney. It was phenomenal.
You say in this book, when you first began to perform Black Sabbath, the girls in the audience ran away from you.
But there's a song called Black Sabbath, that's how we got the name. It was a very demonic riff. But how we started was we decided to write scary songs, because I tell you why, because we used to rehearse across the road from a movie theatre, and I think it was Tony Iommi who said, isn't it weird that people pay money to go and see scary films. Why don't we start writing scary songs? And we, at that point, we were doing jazz and blues, you know, so it's not that far removed from a 12-bar blues riff, you know, some of the stuff.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Well, Netta, the Barnes Foundation and its $25 billion art collection are the subject of a new film. The documentary is called The Art of the Steal. It raises some provocative questions about a plan to move that collection from its home in the Philadelphia suburbs to a nude gallery in downtown Philadelphia. But Barnes Foundation officials and their backers have questions about the film's objectivity. Joe Rose has this report.
Depending on your point of view, The Art of the Steal is either a searing exposé about the biggest art heist of the young century or 2 hours of half-baked conspiracy theories. Former NAACP chairman Julian Bond, whose father knew the Barnes Foundation's creator, opens the film like this.
This is the scandal of the art world in modern America.
We didn't go in with an agenda. We really wanted to tell the story from the ground up, which is what we did.
Director Don Argott, best known for his documentary Rock School, says he'd never even visited the Barnes Foundation before he started working on this film. Producer Sheena Joyce says they tried to tell the Barnes story through the eyes of its founder, Albert Barnes.
It's not our story, it's his story. He left an indenture of trust, and in a sense, that was our blueprint. But it was important for us to make him the main character and bring him back to life for the viewer and tell the story as we thought he would want it told.
Albert Barnes was very particular, especially about his art. He made a fortune in pharmaceuticals and spent it on a collection that includes dozens of Renoirs, Cezannes, and Matisses. Barnes specified in his indenture that the art should stay forever in Lower Merion, just outside Philadelphia. But by the end of the 20th century, the Barnes Foundation was nearly broke, and its board made the controversial decision to move the art collection to downtown Philadelphia. The filmmakers use archival footage, dozens of interviews, and news clips from reporters, including me, to tell the story.
Since it's prohibited from selling any of the works hanging in its Lower Merion gallery, it asked for a court's permission to move the art.
But they got no help from the Barnes Foundation itself. Derek Gilman is the foundation's current president.
It was very clear that it wasn't going to be fair and balanced. Had we participated, it pretty obvious from the title and indeed the thrust of the movie that it wouldn't have been anyway, as indeed it didn't.
Gilman says he knew the film would be biased because of its executive producer.
I admittedly had an agenda in that I thought it was wrong to move the Barnes Foundation, and I told Don and Sheena that.
Lenny Feinberg is a real estate developer who took classes at the Barnes in the 1990s and put up all of the cash to fund the film. But Feinberg insists he didn't tell the filmmakers how to do their jobs.
I tried to stay out of the way. I was involved, but you know, the story just took the steps it took. What is on the film is what happened.
What happened in this telling is a plot hatched in the mid-90s by local politicians and power brokers to break Dr. Barnes's trust and move his collection to downtown Philadelphia, where they hope it will be a major tourist draw. In the film, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Randell calls the move a, quote, no-brainer.
If you were to add the Barnes to the Parkway, there isn't a couple in the United States or in Europe or Asia who's interested in arts and culture who wouldn't come to Philadelphia for at least a long weekend.
Here's how author John Anderson and Los Angeles Times art critic Christopher Knight described the move.
It's fair to say that there was a vast conspiracy to move the Barnes. This obviously involved the three lead foundations, the politicians.
Foundations are nonprofit corporations. We're used to hearing about corporate takeovers with for-profit corporations, but this was a nonprofit corporate takeover.
Not everyone sees it that way. Rebecca Reimel is CEO of the Pew Charitable Trusts.
Anytime you sensationalize something and imply that there's a conspiracy and that someone stole tens of billions of dollars, I mean, that would be enough to probably get anybody to go see a film. That sounds like a pretty good plot. It just turns out that it's all fiction.
Pew is one of three philanthropies that are raising $200 million for the move. Pew is also an NPR financial supporter and partner. Reimel says the Barnes Foundation came to her looking for help, end of story. If there was a far-reaching conspiracy to move the Barnes, former Foundation President Kimberly Camp says the board never told her about it. But then again, Camp says she had a very difficult time raising money to preserve the foundation in Merion.
Were there things in motion that I was not aware of? It's highly possible. We were getting support more from outside of Philadelphia than we were in the city itself. Reasons for that, I mean, anyone could speculate. Private foundations give money to whom they choose.
Both Camp and Reimel declined invitations to appear in The Art of the Steal. Expect the film to provoke more passionate debate when it begins theatrical runs in Philadelphia and New York tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
We're going to stay in the realm of high culture for just a little bit longer, Sonari. Name this composer.
Chopin?
Ah, and guess how old he is?
200.
No! Yes, 200 years old, and to mark that bicentennial, NPR Music's Tom Huizenga and Weekend All Things Considered host Guy Raz discussed the appeal of Chopin's music and spun a few great Chopin recordings.
It is interesting that he didn't really behave by all the rules of the day, which said that you had to write operas and you had to write symphonies and string quartets, but I think you can find all the drama of an opera and all the intimacy of chamber music like string quartets, I think you can find that all over in his music.
And this piece that we're hearing, Tom, happens to be a recording done by Artur Rubinstein, and he actually called Chopin a genius of universal appeal.
I think he hit the nail on the head. Listen, if you go out into the street and say to someone, I'm giving you free tickets to a piano recital, and they're going to play Bach or they're going to play Chopin? They're going to play Schumann or they're going to play Chopin? I mean, I think people would say, I'll pick the Chopin recital.
All right, Tom, let's listen to some of these pieces that you brought in. What's the first one you're going to play for us?
Well, I thought we'd go chronologically through a number of Polish pianists. And I don't think you can talk about Polish pianists and Chopin without talking about Ignaz Paderewski, who was not only a great pianist but also a great composer. And this recording is from 1917, so it's going to sound like bacon frying a little bit. Mm-hmm. But once your ear gets used to it, you'll find that the playing is quite wonderful. And you know what else is interesting about Paderewski? 2 years after this recording was made, he became the prime minister of the newly independent Polish Republic. Hmm. Paderewski was a bit of a star around Europe and the United States. He was always drumming up support for the Polish people. He signed the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. So he was not only a great pianist, he was also a great politician and was a friend of many heads of state around the world, but kept on all the time with his playing.
And so in a sense, was Chopin sort of like a symbol of a sort of Polish, you know, self-determination in a way?
Well, of course, Poles love Chopin, and Chopin's father was French.
French, yeah.
And Chopin said goodbye to his country in the early 1830s, I think, and never actually came back. But many Poles hold on to him as a very special person, a very special musician whose music really says Poland. Especially when he took different forms, Polish dances like the mazurka, and took a rustic dance and made high art out of it.
You can hear the full piece at npr.org/culturetopia.
So we're going to get in the Wayback Machine and go way forward about 200 years.
Excellent.
It has been an excellent year for the Black Eyed Peas. After heading off in separate directions that included getting involved in politics and making films, the group got back together to produce the album The End. The album sold millions and spawned 2 number one hits. They won 3 Grammys this year, including one for their hit single, I Got a Feeling.
Don't make me whistle it. Tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night.
NPR's Lynn Neary sat down with the Black Eyed Peas before a concert in Washington. Lynn asked the Peas, that's what I'll call them, what keeps them working together.
You know, the Black Eyed Peas as a whole is something that I always look forward to.
being on stage and seeing Apple and Fergie and Will on stage with me, it's a unit that it doesn't seem right if I'm performing by myself.
Yeah.
Or if I'm off doing my own thing. Like, I know that that comes with individualism, but I really appreciate having Fergie, Will, and App as my partners.
You know what I like about your music a lot is the fact that there's a lot of humor in it.
Yes.
What you gonna do with all that junk inside your trunk?
I'ma get you drunk, get you love drunk off my hump. My hump, my hump, my hump, my hump, my hump. My hump, my hump, my hump, my lovely little lumps. Check it out.
Where does that come from? Is that the dynamic of the group, or where?
Yeah, yeah, that's our favorite pastime. Yeah. Being on the road is laughter, and you know, we don't take things too serious, or we come up with slogans on the road, and then we start putting them in on the songs, and it's just, you know, our personality. We're like funny people, pretty much misfits.
Yeah.
What about the lyrics? Who writes the lyrics for the most part?
We all do.
You all do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you sort of play with each other with the lyrics? I mean, do you sort of, when you're rehearsing?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. A lot of the jokes, like Apple was saying, a lot of the jokes become the actual lyrics because we just think they're so funny, you know, in the studio.
Yeah.
I wish that everybody knew that we had a sense of humor with all the lyrics like you do, because we're constantly laughing. I mean, we can sometimes barely even get ourselves together to do an interview because we're having our own conversation and laughing. And we don't mean to be rude, but we just enjoy hanging out together. We go to clubs. There are different stories that happen. If people don't go, they get to get filled in on the gossip. And it's fun. It's like a traveling fraternity.
Yeah. And also, we like to constructive criticism, you know? We all come up to Ferg like, yo, is this cool? Or I'll come up to Tab or Will like, is this corny? Or, oh, that's cool. Oh, you should say this, you know? So we like to really collaborate and, you know.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is you're a really diverse group, ethnically diverse group of people. And how do we hear that in your music?
Apple has a lot of songs that are paying homage to his native tongue, which is, you know, he's from the Philippines. And, you know, he has songs inspired by his culture. We have songs that are inspired by the Latin side. We have songs that are inspired by rock, African rhythms. You know, everything that our cultures embody is a vehicle to have inspiration. Whether we go to Mexico and we get inspired by somebody playing a guitarra, right?
Yeah.
Or we go to the Philippines and we see tinkling. Or we go to Scotland and we hear bagpipes. You know, it's whatever country we go to usually inspires us.
Yeah. And then you sort of take that in and make it your own. And part of the way you do it is you're the technical wizard. Is that right?
Well, I am, and me are we produce tracks and stuff.
But so do you take that ethnic music and then add the technical part to it? Is that and
yeah, yeah.
create something
I mean, like,
new?
For example, this album, you know, we're inspired by electro. Dance music, so you know, then we would add our, you know, musicianship in it, our live guitars, our bass lines and stuff like that, so you know, it comes across different.
Well, you can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Sonari, that's it for this week.
Thank you, Netta, for letting me join you again. You can find links to all the stories you heard today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Sonari Glutton.
And I'm Ozzy Osbourne. No, I'm Netta Ulibi.
No, you ain't.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.